Captain of the Enterprise.
That's right.
Close to retirement?
I'm not planning on it.
Let me tell you something. Don't. Don't let them promote you. Don't let them transfer you. Don't let them do anything that takes you off the bridge of that ship, because while you're there, you can make a difference.
Come back with me. Help me stop Sodom. Make a difference again.
Who am I to argue with the captain of the Enterprise? What's the name of that planet? Viridian 3?
Yes.
I take it the odds are against us and the situation is grim.
You could say that.
You know, if Spock were here, he'd say that I was an irrational, illogical human being for taking on a mission like that. Sounds like fun.
Welcome back, everyone. We are here recording the 14th episode of the Shuttle Pod. We are excited, of course. I'm Jared Whitley. I'm one of the co-hosts here, a writer for Trek Movie, and I'm joined by my friends.
Hi, I'm Kayla.
Hey, I'm Brian.
Thanks for coming back. Thanks for coming with us as we explore the final frontier. Now, something that we try to do with this is we kind of alternate between talking about news and more topical events, and then doing like a deep dive into something from Trek's past that we've done with different episodes. Like the most recent one we recorded, which I presume you'll have already heard by now, episode 13, we talk about some of the developments for Star Trek All Access for the new TV show. But then one episode we talked about like Voyager's 20th anniversary. So today, we wanted to go in and do a revisitation of Star Trek Generations, the first TNG movie and the last Jim Kirk movie. So I don't know, when was the last time that both of you may have rewatched this film?
Last night.
Oh, good for you. So it's all very fresh for you.
I watched a couple of scenes from it last night because I wanted to refresh my memory, but I the last full rewatch I did was, I don't know, a month and a half ago, maybe.
Okay, so a while ago. Well, good for you. Okay, so it's fresh in your mind. Now, this is my premise, and you guys have your own, you may not 100% agree with me, but my premise is that Generations is the worst Trek movie ever.
Yeah.
There's a consensus on which of the films are the best, but it seems like a lot of people feel like, oh, no, Final Frontier is the worst for this, no, Nemesis is the worst because of this. I think Generations is easily the worst, because
I will be the one then to say that I don't think that's
okay. And I appreciate your dissenting opinion. But my main reason I think it's the worst is because it fails at what it tries to do, and it shouldn't have even tried to do that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not going to argue with that.
Okay. All right. Well, why would you say? Why would you argue? I mean, I've got, you know, all kinds of notes about why I think it's the worst. Why do you feel otherwise? Or do you want to go through blow by blow from different points on it?
I mean, yeah, we can talk about this as we go point by point, but just in general, I mean, my opinion on this comes from a very visceral place, which is just the fact that I actually enjoy watching this movie. Mm-hmm. So, you know, whether or not it succeeds or fails at certain things, like I'm assuming what you're about to mention before is like the passing of the torch.
Yeah.
From the original series to the Next Generation. And it's called Generations, and it very obviously was meant to do that, and it did sort of fail at that, and it just kind of got weird at the end with Kirk and Picard.
Yeah.
Like, that whole thing was just kind of weird.
Yeah.
But, like, as a film, just, like, as a, like, an experience of sitting in a place and watching a thing for 2 hours, like, that's something I would like to do. Now, like, Final Frontier, like, so if you gave me three DVDs, one was Final Frontier, one was Nemesis, and one was Generations, and it was like, you must watch this film, like one of these films, I would probably pick Generations.
Interesting.
Because it has little moments in it that I really like. And, you know, me and my friends used to watch it and make jokes about it. And the whole thing with the Nexus. And the Nexus gets kind of weird, too. Like, the thing with Picard being in some like house where it's Christmas for some reason.
Yeah.
Is kind of strange, but it's also like some, like, knowing who Picard is.
Yeah.
It's kind of believable, like, that would be his perfect thing.
Yeah. Okay, see,
even though it's weird.
No. Picard's perfect life is something he's already experienced. It should have been his family from the episode The Inner Light. I'm sorry. I had to jump right on that. We can talk about that later. We don't need to talk about it at all.
Yeah.
Right.
It makes no sense why he's already had a family that...
Yeah, but maybe that... I mean, I don't know, because maybe that's in a place in him that, like, that happened already. That's over... You know, because your fantasy isn't going to be something that you've lived. It's going to be this thing that you could never have.
Okay.
This thing that you could never achieve. And for him, it was the fact that he never could have, like, a real family life because he's the captain of the Enterprise.
Yeah.
And I don't think he ever regretted that. But it's, like, a piece of his life that he always wished, like, is sad that he missed out on.
There's this awesome scene in the episode The Defector where this Romulan admiral is lecturing Picard on how important it is to have a family. And I just love that moment where here's this person that he sees as a butcher who's talking to him about family values. Anyway, but
for sure. I know this scene you're talking about.
That's something that's always been part of Picard. And there's this weird jarring intro to it where his brother, who we met in family, and his nephew have died in a fire, right? And so that's what gets mortality on his mind
horrific.
And the whole idea of – Yeah, which is really weird, and it's so odd for them to kill, especially the kid, who the last image we saw of him was him, like, sitting underneath an apple tree, looking up at the stars, and just dreaming, right?
Yeah.
And, nope, the next thing is that he burned to death horribly.
But that was the point of that moment, wasn't it? It was to, like, be soul-crushing. It's like what they do in every Pixar film. It's like make you happy, and then crush your soul, and then build you back up again.
I guess so.
I think that was what they were aiming for anyway.
Yeah, maybe so.
And it obviously is a setup for his thing in the Nexus. So it makes, like, the uninitiated, you know, film goer realize why his fantasy world would be just, like, to have a family at Christmas.
Right. Yeah, which is something that they can understand. Whereas if we saw him wake up with his family from the Inner Light playing his flute, they might have said, wait, what is this?
They would have been like, what the hell is his flute?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. But here, okay, so we launched into it. Well, let's take a step back and talk about
bit by bit.
Yeah, let's talk about some of the behind-the-scenes stuff. Now, why was the studio afraid to go ahead with just a movie with the TNG crew? Why did they need to bring the original cast back?
I don't know if they were afraid, necessarily. I think they just felt that was the way to go. The original cast was this iconic group of people, and I think they felt like they had to, like... Especially to the general public, it felt like they had to, I guess, you know, that old expression, you know, hand the baton. I think that was the primary motivation for it. I think they just felt like you had to see the handoff happen for the general public.
I think it's a very logical motivation that they would have had.
I think so. The way they did it ended up being very awkward and unfortunate, but its heart was in the right place. I mean, originally this movie was supposed to have the entire original cast in it.
Oh, really? And, oh, I hadn't heard that.
Yeah.
So why no Spock and McCoy?
Well, originally, the poster that they came up with in their heads when they were coming up with this whole idea, Ron Moore and Brandon Braga, they said the poster they had in their heads where you were going to see the two Enterprises in battle on the movie poster, and that was like the image that they saw in their heads. Okay, how can we make that happen?
What?
You'd see the Enterprise A and the Enterprise D in combat. And...
against each other?
Yeah, but they couldn't. But
that's
so
weird.
Yeah, but that was the idea. You know, that's how you hook the viewer in. So it's like, okay,
yeah,
it's two Enterprises. Okay, what's going on here?
How does it end up like this?
It's like a Marvel comic where they say it's Punisher versus Wolverine, and they fight for like two panels, and then they team up, and then they're together for the rest of the movie.
Right. It's exactly like that. It's exactly like that. So
is that what the new Captain America movie is going to be?
I don't think it is. I think there's going to be a very sad ending to the Captain America movie. But I don't necessarily want to stray into that because it makes
okay.
Cause it makes
anyway,
me
sad. We'll talk about that later.
Okay. Yes.
Anyway, so they started working on it. And they could not figure out a way to make the two ships end up in combat without one group looking bad. You know, one had to be the heavy in order to make the thing work. So they eventually just ditched it. And then they decided, you know, they would pare it down, and it would be more a movie about the Next Generation cast. But the original cast would be in it. entirely in it. So at the beginning of the movie, you would have seen the entire original cast on the Enterprise B.
Oh, wow.
And during the course of the scenes on the bridge, they eventually, you know, they would have ended the main scene of on the Enterprise B with them all at their original positions on the bridge, which would have been kind of goofy. Oh,
yeah. Yeah, that would have been. Also, I
thought... Oh, because, yeah. How do you explain why these random, like, old-timers that are here to tour the ship, right. basically? And, how do they end up actually at the
right, sure. And then it became an issue of, like, how could they write dialogue for all these people? So they finally gave up on the idea of having the entire cast there, and then they decided, okay, well, we'll just have William Shatner, Leonard Nimoy, and DeForest Kelly. And they started reaching out to everybody, and, you know, obviously the whole premise behind this movie, to some degree, was obviously the meeting of the two captains. So when sure. they offered the roles yeah. to Leonard Nimoy and DeForest Kelly, they both were kind of not particularly interested because it was really nothing more than a glorified cameo.
Yeah. To the point where when they substitute in Scotty and Chekhov, they just give them the same lines. Like, almost, there's this yeah. scene where Chekhov says to two of the reporters, she says, do you have any medical staff? They say, no, they're not here till Tuesday. And he looks at two of the reporters and he said, you just became nurses. And I remember seeing that in 1994 and thinking, wait, why did Chekhov say that? And
yeah, it's because that line was written McCoy's for Bones. Line.
That was written yeah. for Dr. McCoy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so like...
That's a great point. Right?
And the other issue here was that Leonard Nimoy said he would have done the cameo, but when... I don't know, some people may not know this, but Leonard was offered the director's chair for Generations.
Yeah, see, I've never heard that.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It's well documented. And
huh. Oh,
in fact, he apparently wanted he got the script, and he wanted a series of changes done to the script because he realized, like the rest of us, that it wasn't very good.
Yep. Yep.
And Rick Berman basically said, we're too late in the process. We can't make the changes you wanted to make. So Leonard said, oh, then I'm not going to direct the film. And since he wasn't going to direct the film, the notion of just appearing as Spock in a brief cameo didn't appeal to him, so he walked away.
Sure. Yeah.
There's a story. Ron Moore and Brandon Braga tell a story about how they were like walking over to Rick's office one day, and they saw Leonard like walking away from Rick's office like with his head down, and like you could tell the meeting that he had just been in, it did not go well. And then they found out right after that Leonard was not going to be a part of the film.
Ugh.
So Leonard Nimoy could have been the director of Star Trek Generations, everybody. David Carson.
In which case, I think we would not be having this conversation, or we'd be talking about how awesome the film was instead.
Perhaps. Well, it sounds like if he had been the director, he would have made a lot of changes to the script as well. Right. So
yeah.
But I think by the time they bought him into it, it was too far along for him to be making changes, and that was that.
It would be
well, you can take solace in the fact that there was an alternate universe in which they brought him on earlier, and he made the changes that he wanted.
That's a very positive outlook. See,
yeah, if anything it doesn't work out, just remember in some other universe it did. Right.
See, in the alternate universe that I would cite is I think that when they brought Leonard onto the 2009 reboot, they were looking at Generations and they said there needs to be a passing of the torch, but we don't want to do it as bad as that. We want to do it well. And so I think the best decision that J.J. Abrams made was no, Shatner's not going to do this, Nimoy will. Because he's the heart and soul of the franchise.
Well, the only reason Shatner didn't do it is because JJ couldn't figure out how to bring Kirk back from the dead.
Oh, which, of course, is also the fault of Generations. Spoiler alert.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, spoiler alert.
Damn this movie.
Now, here's something.
It was fun.
Yeah. Oh, my. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, here's something that's always kind of baffled me is Generations is sandwiched between two fantastic installments in the franchise, which are Star Trek First Contact and All Good Things, and they're all written by the same two people, by Moore and Braga. And so I've always just wondered, why is this one so weak compared to the other two?
Yeah. Well, I think you kind of hit the nail on the head at the beginning of our podcast, is saying that the reason that you cite it as the worst Trek film is because it failed at what it tried to do, which was the passing of the torch.
Yeah,
there were a lot of moving parts involved too. They had a lot of actors they had to satisfy. There was like, you know, I think there were a lot of politics involved in making that movie that were unique to that particular movie. You know, you had Shatner and Stewart had to be looked after. Brent Spiner had to be looked after. Like there was like a certain amount of hand holding probably that had to go on, and they had to make it work within the context of their story that probably caused some weakness Awesome.
It's interesting you mentioned Brent Spiner, because this came out, I believe, the same year as Independence Day. And I think there was a sense that Brent Spiner's film career was going to take off in a way that it didn't.
No, Independence Day, I think, came out 2 years later.
Oh, 2 years later? Okay, never mind. Oh, you're right.
But
this is the
20th
anniversary.
That is a good perception, though. Brent was and is a highly regarded actor. He's a talented guy.
Oh, no question. No question. And I'm not belittling him in any way as a great performer. Just I think there was a sense that we need to keep this guy with our franchise so he doesn't run to greener pastures.
Yeah.
Okay, in terms of passing the baton, just that phenomenon, my sense was always that they never really needed to do this because there were so many good instances where they already did it, you know, with Bones and Encounter of Farpoint, or Scotty and Relics, or the episode Sarek.
Yeah,
or with
they did it on television.
They Spock and Unification, and they even did it in the previous movie with Michael Dorn cameoing as Worf's grandfather.
Right.
At the trial. So I never felt like they needed to pass the baton.
Yeah.
Yeah. Gene, I know, had felt during the course of TNG that at some point they were going to have to figure out what happened to Kirk. Because it was they were very cagey about it. Anytime his name got brought up, they would not like give you any real indication of what happened to him. And Gene felt that at some point they were going to have to own up to that. And I think
that's one of the primary reasons
why they did it. I mean, you know, and you get a movie poster that has Captain Kirk and Captain Picard on it. I mean,
I'd watch the hell out
of
that.
I would watch that movie 1,000 times when I see that kind of a poster. It's like, my God, it was like, that's like Star Trek fan heaven.
And it's we see, you mentioned Captain America Civil War. We see Captain America and Iron Man on the same poster in 2016, and we just kind of take that as a foregone conclusion. But that kind of thing happens. But in 1994, that was really a novelty to blend two franchises like that.
The Marvel Extended Cinematic Universe didn't exist in 1994. Right. So
yes, it did. It existed just on comic book pages, not in movie theaters.
Not the cinematic.
You're right. Sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry.
But okay. But getting back to Trek, I think I do think it was important for them to do what they did.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I guess I will go ahead and disagree with you, Jared, about the idea that they shouldn't have tried to do it. But I will agree with you that that aspect of it, which was essentially the heart and soul of the film, fell flat.
Oh, horribly flat.
Because let's admit it. Like, the end of the movie is like two old dudes wrestling in the desert.
Yeah.
And it's weird.
Yeah. And it doesn't even fit and I'm not the first person to point this out, it doesn't even fit the internal logic of the plot as it's been established thus far. Because if he can use the Nexus to go anywhere in time, okay, well then go back to right when you meet Malcolm McDowell for the first time and point to security guards and say, arrest this man. And that's it. Then everything's solved.
Yep.
The end. Nope, let's go back like 5 minutes so that we have to scramble to maybe try to defeat him.
And he has a gun and we don't. Guys. Yeah. Okay. And here's something that I want to point out. I mean, bringing them together. Okay, that makes sense. I get that is an important phenomenon. But like, bringing them together should have, you know, whatever plot device brings them together, it doesn't matter, right? But instead, they made what should have been the plot device the entire plot, right?
Yeah.
I mean, totally. whether Q snaps his fingers or somebody jumps through the Guardian of Forever. Or it's hyperspatial chronoton field immersed in interferometric particles. It doesn't matter, right? What matters is they get in the same room together. And it's like when the Borg travel back in time in First Contact, they just say the Borg are opening a temporal anomaly, and Riker explains to the audience who aren't Trek fans. He says time travel, right? That's all they needed to do, right?
Yeah,
And if they'd done that in the first act, and then we have Kirk with us for most of the adventure instead of just appearing weirdly at the end after teaching Picard.
After a horse ride
and teaching Picard that dillweed is good for him to put on eggs. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
the dillweed that's behind the oregano.
I mean, exactly. I paid all this money to watch Kirk and Picard sit there and make scrambled eggs, really?
Yeah.
And I thought that was weird, too, because they had this whole thing with his girlfriend, with Kirk's
Antonia.
Girlfriend, who he was going to go...
Antonia.
Yeah, Antonia. He was going to ask her to marry him. And it's like, this is kind of a cute thing, but like, it's never... It's like, they just made that whole thing up.
Yeah,
right?
Totally.
Like, have we ever heard of Antonia before that moment?
No, it wasn't.
So even for Trek fans, it was like, what?
Yeah, I thought it was
like,
odd.
Like, we weren't invested in that moment.
I thought it was odd that they just didn't make it Carol Marcus.
Carol Marcus, yeah.
Yeah.
But
And we never see Antonia either.
No. No, you see a silhouette of her. She's like on a mountain on a horse, like far away in a silhouette.
That's right. That's right. That's it. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, so that didn't make any sense at all. So, so I think if they'd had some, you know, quick plot device to get Kirk into the action sooner, and then he could have been part of the adventure, and then it had been like, you know, a Lethal Weapon, but in space, where the focus is on the friendship between these two, I think that would have worked significantly better.
Instead of it, like, it was like an afterthought.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and then I also think a lot of the data subplot with the emotion chip is filler because they realized they didn't have enough.
Yep. And the other subplot, which I liked even less than Data with the emotion chip, is the thing with the Klingons and Geordi's visor.
Oh, yeah.
Like, they, like, hack his visor so they can see what he sees.
Yeah.
And then, okay, and then they go and they don't even follow, like, Trek customs in this case. So they're watching his visor so they can get the shield harmonics.
Yeah.
So that they can fire a photon torpedo and it'll go right through their shields. Sure. Right, great. So they see it and they freeze frame this one thing when he's looking past the console.
Yeah.
They freeze it and they see the shield harmonics, punch him in,
yeah.
and then start launching torpedoes. And the Enterprise crew is like, they're going right through our shields. What the devil is going on? And it's like, Rotate the shield frequency. Rotate
like
the shield frequency. Why aren't you rotating the shield frequency?
Like you've done a million times before.
Yeah, like whenever they meet the Borg, it's like we have to set our shields to rotating frequency because the Borg adapt.
Yeah.
Like it's the exact same thing, and they totally abandon that. And it's like Geordi would know that.
Yeah.
And that goes back. I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
No, and that goes back to like one of the things like that Moore and Braga had to do in the script. They had to, at some point, destroy the Enterprise.
Sure.
So that they could build a brand new one for all their feature film adventures. So that was another thing that they had to wedge into the script.
Yeah.
In order to get where they needed to be. So that's like I said, it's just one of many things that they had to deal with. And the movie feels awkward because of it.
Yeah. And I get like in terms of the logic of the series, a Klingon bird of prey is no match for a galaxy-class starship, right? So that they did that to sort of balance the scales. But the other thing they could have done is just said, okay, well, they're not in a bird of prey. They're in a big attack cruiser. Or they have a small fleet of four different birds of prey. There would have been any other way for them to balance the scales without doing the Geordi visor stuff.
Right.
Yeah, or even something, less brute force. Like they have some piece of leverage over the Enterprise, like some reason the Enterprise wouldn't fire on them, like they have a hostage
or they planted a bomb on one of the nacelles or something.
Right, they won't tell you where it is. I mean, that's, yeah.
And I can understand.
We could come up with a better idea.
You know, they didn't want to do, well, it has a cloaking device, but it can fire through the cloak because they'd just done that with Undiscovered Country. So that would have not worked. That would have been really bad, even though they reused some of the same effect shot from that battle.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, and circling back a little bit to back to you guys were saying how much Data's emotion chip subplot kind of sucked.
Yeah.
I think that was written too because they were like, we got to give Brent something to do.
Yeah.
And he gets these little meaty parts where Data has these meltdowns and stuff. And
sure.
And
there's a couple of good moments.
Happy,
see, here's,
and that's it.
This is the thing for me where it's like, I don't. There are things about this movie that I really love. Like that's where the Data Life Form song comes from. And that's adorable.
Yeah,
hilarious.
That is adorable.
Life
you're right.
Forms.
Tiny
little
life
forms.
It's a great moment. And that was in Generations.
And I'll bet that's a song that Brent Spiner would never, ever sing at a convention in 2016.
Nah, even if you offered him money, I don't think he would do it.
I don't think he would. Now, okay, talk about the emotion chip. I think a lot of that also is it provides a little bit more heart to the movie than it had otherwise. Which, you know, that heart would have been there if we'd been able to see Kirk interacting with Picard and other members of the crew. One of the problems I have with this is Kirk gives this advice to Picard where he says, never let them promote you, never let them transfer you, never let them do anything that gets you off the bridge of that ship. But it doesn't really fit for Picard to hear that advice because he's not a young man who necessarily needs a mentor like this. In fact, in some ways, he looks older than Kirk. And he's also, there's nothing where we need to, there's nothing in Picard's character that leads us to believe that he's the kind of Peter Pan figure that Kirk is.
I don't know about that. I mean, Picard remained ship's captain for a very, 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 very long time.
Yeah.
So he did have that same quality as Kirk in terms of he never wanted to leave the ship.
Yeah. Sure.
Like being the workaholic. That was his life. That was his, yeah, he's a workaholic. He's married to his job.
Yeah, he's and Kirk, and one of the nicer character moments for Kirk when he tells Picard, you know, I was so blinded by duty and obligation that I couldn't see past my own uniform. And he goes, and what did it get me? An empty house.
I think that's a great line.
That really is a good line. And it says a lot about Kirk, that Kirk was so narrow-minded and singular in his ambition and his career that when things started to quiet down in his life, he realized how much he had lost. And that ties into what Picard is feeling.
With his nephew and
Patrick Nexus. Does this. Patrick, I was watching it last night. Patrick Stewart does this wonderful thing when Kirk says that empty house bit. Like he almost takes like a sharp intake of breath. Like, oh my God, he's going through the same thing I did.
Oh well.
If you watch it, it's a subtle little thing he does in the scene that like that is really cool.
Huh.
That's kind of the whole thing is kind of sad though too because spoiler alert, Kirk dies. And, you know, it's like he dies having just had regret for the whole end of his life.
Yeah.
Like, that's kind of crappy.
Yeah. See, but something I believe that the scenes that we're discussing, they're echoes of scenes from previous movies. And the two I'm thinking of is the one where McCoy in Wrath of Khan tells him, get back your command before you really get old. And that's what kind of prompts him to you know, McCoy knows this thing about Kirk that Kirk doesn't realize about himself that Kirk then repeats to Picard. And then the other echo is the scene from Final Frontier where Kirk says, I've always known that when I die, I'll die alone. And I love being able to see that Captain Kirk did not die alone.
Yeah, I agree.
And that he died with the only person in the universe who is his peer, so to speak, in a way that even Spock and McCoy aren't.
Sure.
So that I've always been okay with that part of the movie. Him dying, but to the idea of Picard mourning the death of his actual family, something I think would have served a better purpose emotionally for the movie, and would have been better for the ongoing movie franchise, would have been not, you know, the random tragic death of his brother and his nephew, but the idea that his manufactured family of the senior staff of the Enterprise D is beginning to fracture and go their own way. Because we see this awesome scene at the end of All Good Things where he finally joins the poker game, the weekly poker game. And it's like, yeah, this is my family. This is where I belong. Then in the next movie, we see, Riker's finally taking a promotion and Worf is going off to do some Klingon things and Beverly is going to Starfleet Medical and Geordi is going to do whatever with the Starship Challenger so he can appear in an episode of Voyager in 3 years, right? And so I think the idea of seeing his coming to terms with – you know, he has this manufactured family, but even that's not permanent. I think that would have been maybe more poignant, and then it would have led into everybody going off to do their own thing. Because the rite of passage that this movie needed to be was, okay, we used to have these fun weekly adventures, and now we're going to have these amazing adventures every 2 years. You won't see us as often, but when you see us, it'll be more cool. And so setting up for that, I think would have been better. Because something that's kind of unsatisfying in First Contact is everybody's just there, right? We go to the briefing room and, nothing's changed.
Yeah, but if you...
I don't even care.
Yeah, I don't care either. And if,
oh, really? Because First Contact is so... Just because First Contact is so awesome. Well, it's like my favorite movie.
And also, look at the gymnastics that they had to go through in order to get Worf on the Enterprise in every one of those movies. Imagine if you had to do that for the rest of the cast every single time.
Yeah, I guess...
That was like one of the weaker points of First Contact. It's just like, oh, hey, Worf, how's it going?
Mr. Worf, what are you doing here?
That's serendipitous.
That's in Insurrection.
Right. Exactly. Yeah, okay, it's an Insurrection.
In First Contact, it makes perfect sense why he's there.
It does.
The Defiant was created to fight and defeat the Borg.
Right.
Yeah, well, he still just magically ends up on the Enterprise. Sure. Like, there was a whole fleet of ships there.
And somehow none of the rest of the crew from Deep Space Nine was on the Defiant.
Right, just Worf. So, yeah, that was, like, weird, too. But I mean, I don't even care, because it's just like, I don't care, Worf's here, yay.
Right.
Yeah,
but that gets back to, would you imagine if you had to do that, though, with the rest of the cast every single time?
So, Jared, I want to ask you, because I think that's, like, a really interesting idea, if it's, like, a different approach they could have taken as a premise instead of this idea of his family. So if they were to, if you were to write this movie, and that was going to be the premise, is, like, this... His manufactured family is breaking up. What would be Picard's nexus?
Oh, what do you mean?
Like, it, like in this show, like the Nexus is the vehicle to be like, this is what Picard, like, you know, regrets not having. Oh, okay. It's his family.
Okay, well,
it's like a fake
so
family.
I think the thing that's never stated in explicitly in TNG, but is always kind of there, is the idea that Riker is Picard's adopted son, so to speak, because Picard has no children of his own, and Riker is completely estranged from his father. And I've always thought the reason that Riker, or that they could have said, the reason Riker never took command, he said, is because, oh, I wanted to be, it's better to be second in command to a great ship than to be, you know, captain in my own ship. I think the emotional core should have been, no, it's because this is my surrogate father. Mm-hmm. And so I thought some realization and acknowledgement of that between the two could have been really good and really powerful. And then the thing that finally spurs Riker on to realize, no, I need to spread my wings, is Captain Kirk. Because the person that on the Enterprise D who Kirk should have been interacting with, who he had the most common with, wasn't Picard, it was Riker. Because Riker is the mini-me to Kirk, and it's been established that he's kind of a fanboy to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I don't know if anybody wanted to see a movie with William Shatner and Jonathan Frakes in it.
I know. I get it.
I'm sorry, I'm being pragmatic when I should probably just be a fan about it. I'm sorry.
No, that's fine. No, okay. No, it's important. It's important. Art from adversity, right? Sometimes, having challenges is what leads a piece of art to be better. This is not one of those examples.
Right. But you're right, though. they would have a deep connection, probably.
Yeah.
You're right. Kirk and Riker would have a deep connection. There's no question.
I could have seen the three of them, that Kirk, Riker and Picard,
yeah.
And then you can see Picard watching Kirk and Riker play off each other,
yeah.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah.
See,
yeah.
The challenge, and this is a challenge with almost every Star Trek movie, is they have a deep bench because in a weekly serial, you need to say, okay, this is a Geordi episode, and next week it's a Beverly episode, and next week it's a Data episode. But
right.
It's very difficult to juggle all those people all at once.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, and have little subplots for them, like Geordi's visor, yeah. and Data's thing.
To the point where, like with Nemesis, like they just do absolutely nothing with Gates McFadden at all, to the point where it's just kind of infuriating. It's like, if there's anybody...
Yeah, because she's so awesome.
I know. She's the most underutilized resource in the Star Trek franchise.
Yeah.
It's very hard to write for a lot of multiple actors. It was hard with the original cast,
right.
Also.
It is. It is. Yeah, and it took them until... Voyage Home to really get it right,
and even then they still wrote most of the supporting cast pretty light.
But the subplots they did have in that are great, like the whole thing with Bones in the hospital.
Yeah,
yep.
And
Bones and Chekhov in the hospital is fantastic.
Yeah, and Sulu in the helicopter.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was, okay, that's another one of those goofy, like, serendipitous moments. He's like, I used to fly this kind of helicopter. Right. It's like, what? No, you didn't. That's, like, hundreds of years old.
Well, he was bullshitting.
Oh, yeah, he was yeah. joking. Because the pilot says to him, oh, something like this must be old hat to you. And he says, old, but interesting.
Right.
That's true, but doesn't he say, like, I flew these in the Academy or something like
something
that?
Similar to this in the Academy.
In my
okay,
Academy.
Yeah. But it's like, you don't know how to fly that, dude.
Yeah.
There's just
Are you
no,
saying Mr. Sulu can't fly a helicopter?
I am. He cannot fly a 21st century or 20th century helicopter.
Wow.
Yeah. It's like, if they put me in a Model T, I'm pretty sure I would struggle to figure out how to get it to move.
You would drive like Kirk in a piece of the action.
Oh, yeah. I believe it has something called a clutch, Captain.
Oh, God. Yeah. That's even the worst. That's the worst, most egregious thing of that. It's just like, I believe it's called the clutch.
Yeah,
huh? It's like, that is such a horrible line of dialogue. Yeah. Like, you wouldn't just randomly know a piece of...
It's like,
anyway.
It's
Spock. Of course he would.
I digress, but that is ridiculous.
Well, yeah. You could ask people, like, nowadays, what's a clutch in a car, and they won't know, because so few people drive manual transmission.
At least in this country,
yeah.
They,
but in the mid-60s.
And they wouldn't know how to use it.
Sure, but in the mid-60s, they didn't have the automatic.
Well, they probably did, but clutches were still known, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
No, but the thing is, like, I don't know if you've ever driven an automatic, but the first, manual, but the first time you drive it, like, you just keep stalling it. You're not just like, oh, this is called the clutch? Cool. Is this how you use it? Great. Let's go.
Didn't know how to do it, so.
That's right.
Yeah.
Captain,
anyway,
you are an
we
excellent
digress.
Starship commander, but as a taxi driver, you leave much to be desired.
Wait, speaking of I want to bring up a couple of, like, really minor points that I just want to point out as things I didn't like. Or things I thought were silly. Because I love, my favorite thing to do is like pick out this tiny detail, like he shouldn't have known how to fly the helicopter kind of a thing. So I have a couple of them for Generations. So one of them, we were talking about the Data subplot with Data's emotion chip. Why on earth does Data's emotion chip look ridiculous? Yeah. It's like this giant, like, circuit board thing with stuff stuck to it. And it's, like, floating in this little thing. I think you can even see the wire that's, like, holding it up. It looks ridiculous. Yes. And plus, when they show it in the TV show, in TNG, it's, like, this tiny little thing.
Yeah, I think.
And it looks, like, really elegant, like you would imagine 21st century technology.
I think that was for the movie-going audience who doesn't know Star Trek very well, so they understand that that's a microchip.
Yeah.
Oh, sure, but they could have had just, like, a little disc or anything.
Yeah, no, I agree.
I don't know. I don't think the audience is that dumb, I guess.
I think in the novelization, and I could be just making this up giving the franchise a benefit of the doubt, they said that when Data shot Lore in Descent, that it damaged the emotion chip, and so that's where we've seen the emotion chip was kind of reconstructed afterwards.
Okay.
If that's not what they say, they should have, because that's a pretty good explanation. But yes, it looks stupid, and the fact that they need to like plug it into his brain instead of just, like, you know, slot it in wherever. Or, for goodness sakes, just upload the software into his pre-existing matrix.
Well, sure. I understand the idea of, like, having to have a physical thing to show the audience. Yeah. Like, I'm okay with that. But, yeah, and it looked silly. Okay, so that's nitpick number one. I have three.
Okay, let's hear them.
Minor nitpicks. Minor nitpick number two. When they launch... So, when we're on this desert, this area of desert on this planet, and Sauron... What's his name? Sauron.
Sauron is the
not
bad
Sauron.
Guy from
I know. I said that. I said that, and then I thought Lord of the Rings. He's not a giant.
Doctolian Sauron.
Sauron. Sauron is going to launch this rocket into the sun to destroy the sun to move the Nexus ribbon thingy over. Right. Okay. So when he launches this rocket, like it's going up, and Picard's like, "Ah, shit, I missed." And it's going up, and it like as soon as like it like visually like crosses where like the angle of the sun is in the sky, that's like apparently when it hit the sun and it just explodes. So it basically took the rocket like 5 seconds to get from the planet to the sun. Yeah. When, for example, it's an M-class planet with a yellow star. Yeah. So we can assume it's probably like a similar star to our own. And for example, the time it travels for light to get from the sun to Earth is about
eight minutes.
So that was ridiculous.
Yeah,
he would have had a ton of time.
And it's also established that in that time that Worf can't effectively target it, right? So he'd have 8 minutes to get any king.
Yeah, I'm like, well, it's of light travel time, so it probably had much longer than that because it certainly wasn't traveling at warp speed. So they probably had like days, but okay, let's call it hours because we're going to make it a little bit of it. You know what I mean? Like, so even hours is ridiculous.
Anyway. It'll be one boring-ass movie, though, if we were sitting there watching Picard and Sauron just watch this rocket go toward the sun for 8 hours.
Well, no, but they could have just said, like, oh, it's going to get there eventually. So, like, because like, at that moment when he launched it, it was too late. And I would have accepted if they were like, it has the thing, we can't shoot it for some reason. Or maybe the Enterprise had already crashed, whatever.
Or they could have just...
So that, the Enterprise actually had already crashed.
Oh, it had?
I think so.
So they could have had a reason, you know, I would have been happy with that to just say, like, Picard still needs to go back in time because, you know, it already, like, at that moment, that's where he lost, was when the rocket launched, right. So.
You are correct to point out that they were taking some liberties with astrophysics right there.
Yeah, as a scientist, I'd have to. Okay, third and last one, I promise. This is my favorite one. Because I totally recognized it when it happened. So at the very end of the movie, Picard and Riker are on the Enterprise, like, cleaning up. It's just, like, totally destroyed.
Oh, I know what you're going to say.
Just stuff everywhere.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say, too. Go ahead.
Yeah, and he goes into his ready room, and he's, like, looking for
his photo album
of his, like, nephew and stuff.
Which the most valuable thing. That wouldn't exist digitally everywhere, like, on his, you know...
Yeah. Sure. Anyway. But I'm even okay with that. Like, he's the kind of guy who would, like, own a book instead of an e-book.
Yeah,
because he's just the kind of that kind of guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a sentimental guy. So I'm okay with that. What I did, when he picks up this artifact, and he just kind of looks at it and is like, oh, what the hell is this? And, like, throws it. And most Trekkies will recognize that as this really important artifact from an episode of Next Generation called The Chase.
Called, called the Curlin
which is
Nice
given, That's right. And it's given to him by, like, his former professor, I believe.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah, Professor Galen. And he spends like 5 minutes of that show like talking about how freaking awesome this thing is and how it's priceless and you couldn't accept it because it's so amazing. He's like going on and on about it. And I just love this moment where he just picks it up and is like, what's this garbage? Mm-hmm. And like throws it.
Yeah, that artifact also at the end of the episode becomes like the metaphor for the unity of all species in the galaxy. And like the sign that we can have, you know, we had peace with the Klingons, we'll have peace with the Romulans, we'll have peace with everybody, right? That's inevitable. And instead it's like, nope, who cares?
Yeah. Who cares? I love, because I think exactly like what must have happened is someone in the props department was like, we need something for him to pick up. And they just like grabbed that off a shelf.
We got this one.
And no one remembered what it was from.
Yeah.
Including Patrick.
Including him, yeah.
Which he should not be held accountable to.
No, I don't blame him. They film so many of those episodes.
As the actor, his is the delicate genius to make sure the performance is as good as possible. He shouldn't have to worry about continuity.
Yeah, but I'm sure there was someone on that film that was in charge of continuity, and they missed that one.
Yeah,
totally.
So, fun moment, though.
Yeah.
This makes me laugh.
Yeah. There's also a weird scene at the end, like the closing line is like, you know, he gives this speech about, you know, the stated theme of the movie is, you know, beginning Malcolm McDowell says that, he says, they say time is the fire in which we burn, right? And then it closes off with him saying, time isn't the fire, it's a companion, right?
It's a companion that comes with us along the way, which I love that quote.
That's good. And then Riker says, you know, speak for yourself, Captain, I intend to live forever. And it's like, wait, what's that? Is it just to show that Riker, like, he literally hasn't changed because he's still the same cocky guy who I've done?
I think so.
Yeah, totally.
Is that the point?
That's what I got from it.
All right. Yeah, I guess it just seemed a little out of place, right? Because it seemed like he should, like, the main thing he should be saying is, holy crap, you just fought with Captain Kirk. What happened? That's so awesome. Right, anyway,
I thought it was in character. I thought it was fine.
So you like myself. That? Okay.
Yeah, totally. I got a chuckle out. I still get a chuckle out of it whenever he says it.
Yeah. I like it.
I think it's very much in Riker's character to say something like that.
All right.
Did anyone save his fish?
I wonder that too. Because
they got Spot. That was an awesome moment too.
Yeah, and I do like the line where Deanna says, another family reunited. And I do use that phrase sometimes to add drama to moments that don't require them.
It's so sweet. The kid's okay. Everyone's happy. Yeah. If they show me at the end of something terrible that the cat or the dog has survived, that just makes me so happy.
Oh, yeah. You know what? That's also – that may have been a slight reference to the Alien movie, right? Because the – Sigourney Weaver saves the cat, right? She saves Jones.
Right, right.
Yeah, which is like the best part of that movie because it's so
But hard. I also think they needed to save Spot. Fans would have been very upset if Spot had like bought the farm.
But I love that they took the time to even mention him because they could have just not mentioned him and we assume like he's okay.
True.
But I love that they're like, they have him make a little cameo.
Well, and it also ties
Data
up.
Cries.
It also ties up Data's storyline.
Sure. Because he's able to show some emotions positively instead of
And it's just so fun when you know it's coming and they're like, one life sign, very faint. And he like dives into the wreckage to get this cat. Well, he doesn't know it's a cat yet, but still, it's really
and
sweet.
What's funny too is that Brent Spiner hates cats. So
does he?
And with that knowledge, it's funny because when you watch him holding Spot, he can tell he wants nothing to do with the damn cat.
I thought he acted so well that he looks
loves
the cat.
But like, yeah, he doesn't like cats, Brent Spiner, at all.
That's funny.
I never heard that about him. Is he allergic?
Oh, yeah. No, he just doesn't like them.
Okay, well.
I could see that. That's kind of his personality, to not like cats.
Yeah, totally.
Interesting. Okay, now what do we – and we can close this up. We've been going for a while. I don't want to necessarily belabor this. What did we think about the villains of the movie? Do we like
Saren.
Did you? Okay.
I'm a big Malcolm McDowell fan, so
I like Malcolm McDowell. Yeah,
I can watch him do anything. And
he added a lot of gravitas to it.
Yeah,
I think it's cool that they bring in an Alaren, someone from Guinan's.
Yeah,
race.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, how
like she's always such an enigma,
sure. and she's so good at figuring people out. What if she went bad? What would that be like?
Yeah.
And having Larissa and Batura there, I mean, that was fun. It would tie into the series, you know.
I really like that.
Yeah.
I really like that. That they needed some muscle, and they're like, hey, why don't we bring them back? I thought that worked well, too.
I love their characters. I'm just not a huge fan of that subplot. But I do love Larissa and Batura.
I also love that they introduced the term trilithium as like, ooh, it's even worse than, it's even more explosive than dilithium.
But trilithium had been in TNG before as something completely different, hadn't it?
Well, there's the episode, where the terrorists sneak onto the Enterprise while it's being cleaned, and they try to steal some resin from the warp core. I don't know if they use the term dilithium or trilithium.
Right. Okay, I thought it was trilithium. I could be wrong. I seem to remember them using that term twice, and it being two different kinds of things.
I'm doing a very, very cursory search of Memory Alpha. And the first mention of it on Memory Alpha is just them talking about the Dura sisters in this movie and in Generations. Okay. And then they also mention it being mentioned trilithium isotopes are found in Romulan plasma torpedoes, but that was in a Deep Space Nine episode called Image in the Sand. And then it appeared in Voyager Course Oblivion.
Okay.
Someone collected samples of trilithium ore. And it was also in Voyager The Chute and Space Nine's Inferno's Light. So it looks like it hadn't been mentioned in TNG. Okay. At least it's not written on Memory Alpha.
Well, if it's not there, then it's not there.
That's
right.
I'm just misremembering. That's all.
It's Memory Alpha is gospel. I'm okay with that.
Totally. I did want to bring up one other thing.
Oh, before we move on from Malcolm McDowell, I just wanted to point out, I really like that the motivation for the villain is, you know, and it's kind of the opposite of Picard. Picard needs to learn to move on with his life, and Malcolm McDowell can't, right? He can't let go of the grief of his people having been destroyed by the Borg. And so I like how there's that kind of opposite to it, of Picard is more mature about dealing with mortality than an Elorian is, who, as far as we know, is functionally, you know, lives for hundreds of years. The thing that kind of annoys me with that is I feel like it's kind of in contrast to that counsel that Kirk gives to Picard about don't let them promote you, don't let them transfer you, be Peter Pan. And maybe I'm reading too much into that, but it just seemed like it could have used another rewrite to hang a lantern on that a little bit better.
No, I see what you're saying. That's a good point.
Yeah, but I also need to point out, and most people probably know this, Malcolm McDowell is Alexander Siddig's uncle.
Right.
Wait, in real life?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and in fact,
did I know that?
At the convention, somebody asked him about that, and he said, well, my uncle was very supportive when I told him that I was getting the job with Deep Space Nine, with Star Trek, but he said that Malcolm McDowell had some negative interaction with fans who blamed him for killing Captain Kirk. And he didn't want to deal with that anymore.
That's hilarious.
Yeah. Which segues nicely into what I wanted to bring up is, like, obviously this movie's most notorious for the death of Captain Kirk.
Sure.
And I just wanted to know what you both thought about the way that was handled.
Well, I mean, I'd mentioned that thing. I liked that he didn't die alone, right? To sort of the echo from Final Frontier, which that scene where he says that very dramatically and very kind of macho. And then McCoy says, well, we'll call Valhalla and have them reserve a room for you.
I love that.
That's a
great line.
You know, there's a lot of problems with Final Frontier, but they get boned so well. And anyway.
Yeah.
So I like that aspect to it. The fact that he gave his life to save a planet that he doesn't know about at all, right? It's just, you know, it's like a Bronze Age with a population of 120 million or something like that, if I remember correctly. And we never see anything about the planet. That some people have criticized that, but I actually kind of like that, where it's like, no, this is what I do, right? I save planets. This is my job. However, like, the fight leading up to it was so unsatisfying that it was hard for it to feel as engaging as it should have been. I mean, like, if you look at Spock's death, like, everything leads up to that in the previous act in terms of the conflict between the Enterprise and the Reliant, and it's very dramatic and it's very intense, and the music just builds the tension so beautifully. And there's that great scene where they're moving at impulse speed away from the Reliant, and the music has just got you on the edge of your seat. And Kirk is like trying so hard to be composed on behalf of his shipmates and his crew. And Sulu says things like, "We're not going to make it, are we?" And David's like, "No, there's no way we can escape the Genesis wave." And then finally it comes and it's explosive, and you know, we have this beautiful scene of the Enterprise warping away. And then it's like, "Oh no, Jim, you better get down here. Something's happened," right? So it's built up to so beautifully, where this, it just kind of happens in the middle of a scene.
Yeah.
I could not have said that better.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, because, it's like, like you said, you explained the death of Spock so perfectly and why it works so well, so perfectly. But here in Generations, it's like, come, like, punch some dude in the desert with me.
Yeah.
And then, like, fall off a bridge and then just die.
And basically what they made him was a red shirt, right? He dies like a red shirt should die.
Yeah, it's like an inconsequential death. It's not like he was, like, you know, making the final blow or, like he wasn't in the act.
Right.
Really, of doing something. He was just, like, on a bridge.
It would have been better if he had just died on the Enterprise B at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, it would have been.
He would have been saving the Enterprise, and that would have been the end of it. You know what I mean?
Like, that was a more heroic death. Like, I mean, I see why they didn't, because, no, like, of course, we wanted him in the film later. But, yeah, in terms of, like, if you just, like, out of context, had to pick a death for him, the Enterprise B death is a much better one. Yeah.
And the other sad thing about the movie is that William Shatner and Patrick Stewart have really good chemistry together.
Amazing.
Amazing chemistry, and you don't really get a chance to enjoy it very much.
Because they're like, talking about
and
eggs.
That's another thing. Yeah, like, I felt like they could have, I could have watched an adventure between the two of them for an hour. Them going off and doing some cool Star Trek stuff. You know what I mean? Like, and
yeah, like getting to know each other instead of just like, let's ride a horse.
Swapping
okay.
stories.
Right, and that would have, and we would have had this great adventure, it would have been this great ride, and the audience would have been into it. And then when Kirk dies, it would have been really devastating.
Yeah.
Like, it just feels there's this weird disconnection the way Generations.
Yeah,
because
at that point, Picard doesn't really know him except for from the history books.
Yeah, they've barely met. Yeah, there's nothing deep there at all.
Yeah. So. Okay, so we're coming towards the end of our time. So, either of you guys have anything else you wanted to bring up? Because I wanted to see.
One other thing I thought it would have been nice to see would have been for Kirk to have interactions with Worf, because, like, his arc in Undiscovered Country is he needs to forgive the Klingons, right? He needs to overcome, you know, he's been trained his whole career to fight these people, and now he can't do that anymore. And then here's the opportunity for him to fight alongside one of those people. I think that would have been nice to have a scene between the two.
What does Worf even do in Generations?
He provides the technical information about, he gets promoted,
Bird of Prey.
And then hazed
immaturely
by Riker. In terms of being, you know, thrown into the ocean, when Riker asks him, "What are the weaknesses of this brand of bird of prey?"
Of Klingon ship, that's funny because when you said Worf should have, I had a moment where I was like, "Wait a minute, was Worf in this movie?"
Barely, like,
I totally, barely. Yeah. And then of course, the only thing I remember is that scene at the beginning in the Enterprise C ship.
Yeah.
Oh, and I also like to say that, like, I thought that the movie is beautifully shot. To me, it's the most, it's cinematography wise, it is the prettiest of all the Star Trek films.
Really? Even more so, I thought you would have said the motion picture.
No. The Generations is beautiful. John Alonso shot Star Trek Generations, and John Alonso shot Chinatown and a lot of other great films.
Wow.
And he lit those sets, those TV sets, to make them look so different and so cool. And I don't know, he bathed everything in a kind of a golden glow. And I just thought he did a beautiful job with the entire film. And like I said, they redressed those sets to some degree between the end of All Good Things and the beginning of Generations. Obviously, the bridge looks a bit different and stuff. But he really lit them in such a way that made them look absolutely spectacular, better than they ever had, in my opinion. So I just wanted to say, as a film buff, I just love the way the film looks.
So something that I'm not sure had a feel about how the scenes are lit on the Enterprise is I feel like it's meant to be reminiscent of like a sunset, because we have like the lower light level but still kind of the orangey glow. And is he trying to say like, okay, the sun is setting on the old adventures that you used to see with the Enterprise crew? That's kind of how I felt with it. I'm not sure. I may be reading too much into it.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't speak to that, but that is that look though is very cool, and like he really sells that when Data and Geordi go into 10 forward and it's just bathed in sunlight. Yep. So I just wanted to mention that. It's my favorite Star Trek movie to actually just look at.
Huh, I'll have to rewatch it with the nice set.
See, so it's not the worst, like, all around. Like, it has, my closing statement for In Defense of Star Trek Generations is that It's not the perfect film. It has a lot of problems and a lot of stupid moments and things. But there's also a lot of really great stuff about it. Like, and it's a movie that I enjoy watching.
Okay.
All right.
So that is my piece.
I will say I do like stellar cartography. I like that scene where we see.
Yeah, me too.
We've got a bigger budget to do some cool science stuff, so we'll do that.
And in 1994, that was pretty heavy duty.
Yeah, it was. It was. Also, that set would become the template for Seven of Nine's set in Voyager, because
astrometrics. Yeah.
Oh,
I also, and I'm, you know, this may be something everybody knows, but the problem with the costumes. They didn't have enough costumes to go around, so they just took some of the Deep Space Nine uniforms and threw them on some people on the Enterprise D. So we have this weird like contrast of the old Starfleet uniforms and the new Starfleet uniforms to the point where some of them
it's noticeable.
Yeah, and some of them
I meant to bring that up.
Jonathan Frakes is too tall for the uniform he's wearing, and you can see that his sleeves don't go all the way down to his wrists.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. Okay, that was actually a big one that I forgot to bring up, is why, I didn't know that was the reason, is why do they have people in the mix?
Yeah.
Like, pick one. Yeah. They would never do that on a military ship.
No, also the thing that's established on Deep Space Nine is that the uniforms they're wearing are, like, for this space station that's not an official Starfleet installation, but whenever we see visitors from a different Starfleet ship, they're wearing the traditional TNG uniforms. Right, so it's like
right, and then Voyager kind of wrecked that.
Well, I know, but I think at that point, and I'm gonna, you know, sound very crass and vulgar here, but I think what they did is they realized, okay, we've sold as many of the old uniforms as we're gonna sell. We need to have these new uniforms so we can sell some more ones.
Oh, no, totally. I get them having new uniforms, but I like the idea that I wish they had created new ones for Voyager instead of just using.
Yeah,
I
wish they'd introduced the first contact uniforms in Voyager, because the first contact
uniforms
are
awesome.
Fantastic.
And also, who ever thought a purple dicky was a good idea? I'm sorry, but it's really odd. It's like a violet dicky.
Yeah, yeah.
Odd choice. Odd choice in the future.
Odd choice. Okay. Well,
so,
anything else? Any final shots?
Have we said our thoughts?
I think so. We could always speak more about this stuff, but
yeah.
I think we covered the high points.
Yeah.
One of these times we have to do an episode of, like, our favorite, like, nitpicking things from one. Like, our favorite, like, science gaffes or, you know.
Oh, we could totally do that.
Continuity gaffes or whatever.
I would love to do that.
So I guess then for this episode, we can close out with a Treknikdote. I have one for the first time. So my Treknikdote this week, is going to be something that I talked about a couple episodes ago. I believe it was in the convention episode, when we were talking about Star Trek Mission New York, which is this big CBS run and Reed Pop run conventions happening in New York, this September. And I had called them to ask them some information about the convention, and they have a number you can call. It's on their website. I would encourage everyone to go and listen to it because it's amazing. They've decided to make their answering machine service like Trekified. And so they've just tried to drop in like little Star Trek references wherever they can, but they kind of don't work, but they do so in a way that I find extremely endearing, because it just makes the people recording it seem like these super nerds and like super awkward and geeky, and I'm like, I'm super awkward and geeky and nerdy, and so it makes me feel like, but they like are super enthusiastic about it, right? And they like tried to make this thing like Star Trek-y, because they're like, yeah, the fans will love this, you know, and it's just like kind of weird.
It's great.
And it kind of sounds like they copied and pasted stuff, like, rather than necessarily saying, okay, this is going to be some loving homage and made it sound like a captain's log or something like that. I don't know.
Right. Yeah. No, it's like they very obviously like, you know, separate out the Star Trek part of it. So they'll be like, for example, they're like, they're saying if you need information on like hotel reservations in the area. And instead they say, if you're looking for hotel information for your trip to the Delta Quadrant, press 5. And it's just like, what? Wait a minute. New York is in the Delta Quadrant? I don't get it, but okay. But it's just like really adorable. Yeah, they're like, oh, and they also say, you know, if I think it's when they're talking about the talking to one of their staff people, basically, and they're like, one of our Starfleet red shirts will be with you, and it's like, wait a minute, That's, you don't want to be a redshirt. You don't get this.
Yeah. They get A for effort, though.
Absolutely.
They do, because I'm really not making fun of them, even though it maybe sounds like I am. Like, I love the fact that it's kind of awkward. I think that makes it even more authentic.
Yeah, I agree.
And endearing, yeah.
So we're going to drop the audio in here so you guys can all enjoy that, because it needs to be shared, I think.
And try to get to New York for the convention, guys.
We'll be there.
We'll be there. And as of right now, so will William Shatner, so far.
The headlining guy.
Well, yep. Start at the top.
Yeah.
You know, I feel kind of bad. I've never seen, like, Shatner and Stewart on stage at the same time. I mean, I've seen pictures of that, but
I've never seen them either.
They used to do, when the two of them would be at Creation Con, like at Vegas, they would do like a handoff thing where they would both be up and then snap some pictures. And then, yeah, so like towards the end of Patrick Stewart's time, for example, Shatner would like peek his head out and everyone would cheer, and he'd be like, "Oh, it's William Shatner," and then they'd like hold hands and take pictures and whatever.
I would love to see that. My favorite part of the convention last year was when we had three of the TNG guys up at the same time that Stewart was signing autographs, and so he went up. There's this great moment where he goes up, you know, and he walks on the stage and everyone's cheering, and then he pulls out his phone and says, "Oh, this is just where I get the best reception," which okay then. Right. Well, thanks for sharing, everybody. Thanks for coming with us on the podcast. Hope you all enjoyed it. And we will see you in the next one in a couple weeks.
Thanks, guys. See you later.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you for calling the United Federation of Planets and the home of Star Trek Mission, New York. For information on visiting Star Trek Mission, New York, as an attendee, please press 1. To speak with a Starfleet customer service red shirt at any time during this call, please press 9 to make it so. Thank you for calling Star Trek Mission, New York. Your call may be monitored by the Borg for quality assurance purposes. If you are interested in purchasing a booth to become an exhibitor or would like a copy of your holodeck program or floor plan, please press 2. If you would like information to make your Delta Quadrant hotel and travel arrangements, please press 6. To repeat this menu, please press 8. To speak with one of our customer service red shirts, please press 9 at any time during this call to make it so.